section here to begin the meetings with a short reading from the rules. So I just have a very small section. It's from chapter 7 on humility. The 11th degree of humility is that when a monk speaks, he do so gently and without laughter, humbly and seriously, in few words and sensible words, that he not be noisy in his speech. For it is written, a man who is known by fewest of his words. So, no pressure, Father John. That's right, not a Benedictine. So that was, I was searching for a reading, and actually I went to the OSB site, and they do a little section every day, and that was actually yesterday's reading, so I thought, okay, it's perfect, it's appropriate, we'll do that one. So, so I'd like to, my honor, to introduce Father John Maria Devaney, OP, a Dominican friar. Not a Franciscan, thank you. Father John grew up and was born and grew up right up 78 in Clinton, New Jersey. Attended school at Immaculata in Somerville, New Jersey. And then went to Emerson College in Boston and graduated with a BA in communications with a concentration in audio and radio. For 15 years, he worked as a disc jockey, so I think you'll be okay with your voice. Yeah. Father John currently serves in Manhattan for the Archdiocese in New York and can be heard on Sirius XM Radio, which is actually how I found out about Father John. I got a new car and had XM Radio and found the Catholic Channel, and so I was trying to come up with a speaker for this year, and as you know, the Year of Mercy, and Father John will speak more about it, but he was commissioned a missionary of mercy by the Pope in February. So I thought, what a perfect fit. I'll try and get a hold of him. So I tracked him down on the internet, and here he is. he's also part of the Dominican Friars Healthcare Ministry in New York, where he's the chaplain and the ethicist. So without further ado, Father John.
Thank you. Great honor to be here. And we have about 90 minutes, and we're going to split it up. We're going to do 40 and 40. We'll take about a 10 or so minute break in between. And today what I'd like to do is look at mercy in the rule of St. Benedict. Also, of course, I have to bring you some Thomas Aquinas. And I know we're celebrating our 800th year this year. You guys are, probably 1800 years now, right? Almost, yeah. So we're babies, you know. Yeah, we haven't even qualified for Catholic Social Security yet, compared to the Benedictines, you know. Yeah, we're still paying our student loans back, basically. Where the Benedictines have paid theirs off, you know. So we'll have two breaks, and the two things we'll talk about. I want to first talk about the Year of Mercy, and talk about how Pope Francis got this going. Some of my experiences as being one of these 1,000 priests commissioned as a missionary of mercy. Then we're going to go into the rule, and mercy appears 4 times in the rule, and I'll tell you the chapters and the like. I'm sorry, I don't have a handout for you. I'll keep my notes, and we have a recording, so that way if you want to go back, you know, we'll have some of the details if you need it, if you do like to keep notes. Then also, too, so we'll see how far we get, and there's 4 areas of the rule with mercy. We'll see how far we get in the first 40 minutes, and then wherever we stop the break, we'll continue in the rule, or what we'll do is if we've gotten through it all, which probably we won't, we're going to look at some psalms, mercy and psalms, since that's so dear to all the oblate's life. I want to definitely include some of the pillars of the Benedictine life and the oblate life, especially, you know, praying the liturgy, the hours, as we do too as Dominicans. And then, of course, kind of looking at that a little bit from the Lectio perspective as well. So looking at especially Psalm 51. So with that, one of the prayers of St. Benedict, as you probably all know, and the Benedictines know well, the O Lord, I place myself in your hands and dedicate myself to you. And then, of course, it's almost like a mini version of the rule, this prayer of St. Benedict. I pledge myself to do your will in all things, to love the Lord God with all my heart, all my soul, all my strength, not to kill, not to steal, not to covet, not to bear false witness, to honor all persons, not to do another what I would not wish done to myself, to chastise the body, to not seek after pleasures, to love fasting. I took the fourth vow of obesity from the minute you do poverty, chastity, obedience, and then you can take the fourth vow if you want. So I took that fourth vow. So I can't say that I'm as good as a fasting as the Benedictines. And then to relieve the poor, to clothe the naked, to visit the sick, to bury the dead, to help in trouble, to console the sorrowing. And what do we hear in this prayer right there? We hear the corporal and spiritual works of mercy right there in St. Benedict's prayer, the great prayer of St. Benedict. And we'll get into that later. We'll talk about the works because that's in the rule, as many of you probably know well. To prefer nothing to the love of Christ, to not give away to anger, to not foster a desire for revenge, to not entertain deceit in the heart, to not make a false peace, not to forsake charity, not to swear lest I swear falsely, to speak the truth with heart and tongue, not to return evil for evil, to do no injury, yea, even to bear patiently any injury done to me, to love my enemies, not to curse those who curse me, but rather to bless them, to bear persecution for justice' sake, not to be proud, not to be given to intoxicating drink, not to be an overeater, not to be lazy, not to be slothful, not to be murmured, not to be a detractor, to put my trust in God, to refer the good I see in myself to God, to refer any evil in myself to myself, to fear the day of judgment, to be in dread of hell, to desire eternal life with spiritual longing, to keep death before my eyes daily, to keep constant watch over my actions, to remember that God sees me everywhere, to call upon Christ for defense against evil thoughts that arises in my heart, to guard my tongue against wicked speech, to avoid much speaking, to avoid idle talk, to read only what is good to read, to look at only what is good to see. Thank God St. Benedict didn't have social media. To pray often, to ask forgiveness daily for my sins, and to seek ways to amend my life. To obey my superiors in all things, not to desire to be thought holy, but to seek holiness. To fulfill the commandments of God by good works. To love chastity, to hate no one. To be jealous or envious of anyone. Not to love strife, not to love pride, to honor the aged, to pray for my enemies, to make peace after a quarrel before the setting of the sun. Thankfully, for the monks, the sun sets later in the summer, so if there's more time to make peace amongst the brethren this time of year. And now the last line of this prayer of St. Benedict. Never to despair of your mercy, O God of mercy. Amen. So St. Benedict ends his prayer, thank you to EWTN for their great catalog of prayers of the saints, with mercy. St. Benedict ends his prayer with mercy. Never to despair of your mercy, O God of mercy. Amen. And look at that. I mean, the whole, if you want to talk, Aquinas wrote the Summa, right, Theologica. This is almost the whole Summa of the Gospel. St. Benedict, again, ahead of the times, you know, 1,000 years before we began. And what a great thing to think. What does he say last? These last words, this last prayer on his lips of St. Benedict, never to despair of your mercy, O God of mercy. So the Holy Father, Pope Francis, decided to declare an extraordinary Jubilee Year of Mercy. That's very interesting. I'll give you kind of the run-up of how some small bit of insider information I found out. Nothing too deep, but so I am a missionary of mercy. Like I said, Dominican friar, I'm a healthcare chaplain, primarily at the hospitals, New York Presbyterian Cornell Hospital, Sloan Kettering Cancer Hospital, and the special hospital for special surgery, right? A lot of knees and hips there. I meet a lot of people in New Jersey and Connecticut, New York. And I'm a chaplain about 4 days a week, and then Fridays I do the SiriusXM radio show. So as Kristen shared, I was a disc jockey in public radio before I became a priest. Very long story. But I met the Dominicans in New York around 2006, and then right around the death of Pope John Paul, I started thinking about the priesthood. And then I think the Marian devotion of the Dominicans is kind of what pulled me in. And what's interesting too, though, was going to Immaculata in Somerville and Immaculate Conception Grammar School in Somerville. The only religious I knew growing up was the Capuchins that would come out of 31st Street by Madison Square Garden to my home parish, Immaculate Conception in Clinton, New Jersey, out on 78. And then, so I remember the Franciscans coming, coming. And then I do remember, I mean, really, in my opinion, some of the most famous, at least in that area, well-known religious were the Benedictines of Delbarton, because that school was very well-known. I know some of the chapter of Delbarton's oblates are here with us today. So I always knew who the Benedictines were. Just never, I mean, good education in Immaculata and good Catholic family. But this is funny though, the Irish, coming from an Irish American family, we all know who Martin de Porres is. You know, there's a great devotion to St. Martin de Porres, but I never knew he was a Dominican, you know. And of course, a great devotion in the Irish to Padre Pio and Our Lady of Fatima. So I grew up around with that, but never knowing who St. Dominic was. In my work as a hospital chaplain, I was working with a Capuchin, excuse me, a priest by the name of Father Alan Harris, who is the chaplain to a hospital called the Allen Hospital, which is the top of Manhattan, above Washington Heights in Inwood up there. And so he came in, we were doing like a group work of the chaplains I participated in for about 6 months. We'd meet once a week for a number of hours and share stories and critique each other's bedside manner, things like that. It was very, very informative. And he says, I have to go to Rome in February. This is back in maybe October. He says, yeah, I have to go as a missionary of mercy. I've been chosen by my superior to go to Rome, and Pope Francis chose us to go. And I was like, oh, I think we got an email about that. So I go back, we get bi-weekly emails from our superiors locally in New Jersey. In our province. I'm in the province of St. Joseph, by the way. Our geographic territory is Ohio and Kentucky, up to New England, down to Virginia. And side note, the first Dominican monastery of women, because we do have nuns, was here in Newark, the Dominican Monastery St. Dominic's, now in the possession of the Franciscan Friars of the Renewal. So I imagine there's a lot of old history. Father Augustine and I were talking about that before. And then St. Antoninus in Newark was a Dominican parish for a long time here as well. So a few Dominican roots here, especially Dominican monastic life, the female monastic life here in Newark. So I went back and I saw that we had an email link from one of our superiors saying, whoever would like to apply to be a missionary of mercy, you can click here. And the local superior, our provincial, we call him, Father Ken, will give you a letter of endorsement. So I was like, oh, that sounds kind of neat. And I was like, yeah, maybe with the work I do, you know, there's a lot of times you go to people's deathbed, a lot of very ill people. So, you know, great corporal works of mercy, spiritual works of mercy. I clicked through and I was brought to the Pontifical Council for the Promotion of the New Evangelization's website for the Year of Mercy. Now, the website for the Year of Mercy is extremely easy to remember for any of you who'd like to go to it. It's very good, and I'll repeat it again. But you have to put the three W's in front of it because it's in Italy. It's a European address. So it's Immaculate, M as in Mary, .va. It's that simple, im.va. Or if you just web search Jubilee Year of Mercy, but www.im.va. And all the resources for the Extraordinary Jubilee Year of Mercy are there. So this council, which was started by Pope Benedict in 2010 as a response to, if any of you remember, there was a synod on the new evangelization around 2009, 2010. So Pope Benedict says, we're going to start this council to help promote the new evangelization. And which the heart, the biggest part of the heart of the new evangelization is really to try and recall Europe back to its Christian roots and to remember the Christendom, the Catholic, even the Christian roots, dare I say, with the 500th anniversary of the Reformation coming up, of Europe, of continental Europe. And of course, as we as Americans and North Americans thinking of ways of how we can be in the new evangelization as well. So that being said, this pontifical council is headed up by Archbishop Rino Fisichella. He's an Italian who taught theology in Rome for many years, and he was chosen by Pope Benedict to start this council. So he has been the right-hand man to Pope Francis for the Extraordinary Jubilee Year of Mercy. So they ask priests, the Holy Father, when he put out the bull of mercy and the bull for the year, Misericordiae Vultus, that was a Divine Mercy Sunday of last year, 15, he announced it. Pope Francis called out for missionaries of mercies, for priests to be special representatives for him in the church throughout the world. So he said you could apply and get this letter. So I applied and I got the letter from my superior, and on Thanksgiving Day, we're just about to go down and eat together as a community, because as Dominicans, St. Dominic took a few of the elements of monastic life. So we try to always be together for at least morning prayer and evening prayer. Usually we're out in the apostolate for midday prayer. We eat together, common life together, the vows together, pray together, and obviously put all our funds in common, and then we have our local superior like the abbot. So the Holy Father So we got the letter. I put my application in. Thanksgiving Day, I open up my email just about before we're going to eat. And I see .va at the end of one of my emails in the inbox. And I was like, oh my gosh, that's the Vatican. So I click it open. How often do you get an email from the Vatican? You know, so I click open the email, and it's a letter signed by Archbishop Reno Fisichella. It says, Dear Reverend Devaney, we're happy to inform you that the Holy Father has chosen you to be a collaborator in the Year of Mercy as one of the missionaries of mercy. You will be a maternal a sign of the Church's maternal care for her children. And you'll be expected to go out and preach on mercy and be persuaded. So he goes on all the details. And then it says this one thing. It says, also the Holy Father is requesting you to go to Rome, all the missionaries to gather in Rome, February, it was 9th and 10th, so Fat Tuesday, Ash Wednesday, to be with him for a meeting on the Tuesday and then to concelebrate Mass with him on Ash Wednesday at St. Peter's. So I get this email. And I'm like, oh my gosh, this is amazing, you know, and I'm quite honored, you know, quite floored. And so we're going down to dinner. I was like, well, I'm going to keep my mouth shut. I'm not going to go down to Thanksgiving and be like, hey, I just got an email from the Vatican, everybody, you know. So maybe it was a little bit of humility, or maybe just prudence more than humility, I think. I didn't want to make my brothers jealous. Because on a side note, we do have brothers in the order, men who are not priests, you know, like Martin de Porres wasn't a priest. And some of the older brothers who are very jovial, we get along well, but I've heard a couple of times at table, I had to wait 25 years to get to Rome, you know, until I made solemn vows. You know, so kind of like the younger priests, we've gotten to travel a little more than the older friars. So I've gotten jabbed a few times, like getting to go to Rome so quickly after being ordained. So I went to my superior, and under obedience, I said, so should I go to Rome? And he said, yes, absolutely. This is an invitation. You should go. He said, take a couple of days extra. And, you know, be with the Dominicans. And fortunately, as religious, we kind of have a place to lay ourselves almost anywhere in the world. You know, it's a great gift. I don't know if oblates are allowed to stay at the monasteries throughout the world. So that's a great gift as well. You know, you get to share in the joys and the fruits and participations of the Benedictine order, just like we in our laity get to share in our traditions as well. So we get to... I do some radio on Friday still on Sirius XM on the Catholic channel. The Dominicans have had the show for about 10 years, and then when they found out I was coming to New York to do the hospital work and my background in radio, they asked me to host the show. So when I found out I was allowed to go to Newark and I was going to take, Rome, and I was going to, close, very close, very close, very old buildings, lots of graffiti, you know, Rome's full of graffiti, you know, it's very, you know, the Benedictines, the Dominicans, the Franciscans, you know, so the Jesuits in Rome, I mean, in Newark, so he says, yes, go. And I go to the bosses at Sirius XM, and I said, could we broadcast the show from Rome, from Radio Vatican, that Friday? And they said, oh, absolutely, we've got great connections with Radio Vatican, they send the signal back to the United States, no problem. You know. So then a couple of weeks go by, it's maybe around Christmas, and then the guy who does the morning show, his name is Gus Lloyd, does a show called Seize the Day, he said that he was going to be in Israel doing a pilgrimage, and he wasn't going to be able to make the morning show. So the bosses say, listen, can you host the morning drive from Rome for 5 days, and it's 2.5 hours straight of radio? And I'd never done that much, maybe like an hour. And as a disc jockey, I was doing music. So you talked for 2 or 3 minutes, maybe a long time, interview once in a while, you have a music. But now to do like 2.5, even being a Dominican, even being Irish, I was kind of like, oh, yeah. And for all transparency, when Chris and I were speaking today, I was like, all right, so yeah, I'm doing a 45-minute presentation. Like, oh, no, actually, we have 90 set aside. So for the last like couple of days, like, oh, I got 90 minutes. How am I going to fill 90 minutes? And even put together the last few notes, but it'll go fine. So I go to my superior. I said, listen, they've asked me to do the whole week. I don't want to do the whole week going to Rome for the first time. I want to walk around and look at churches. I'm on pilgrimage. I don't want to, you know, work. And he said, no, you should do it. It's the 800th anniversary of the Dominican Order. We have lots of American Dominican friars. What a great opportunity to broadcast from Rome. So I said, okay, under obedience, I called back the people. I said, yeah, I'll do the show. And it turned out being it was a great, great blessing. I mean, to be in Rome, to get to broadcast, got to broadcast from the studios that St. Pope John Paul II, they're called the Carol Wojtyla Studios. They're very fascinating because Radio Vatican has been around since, you know, 1930s, really one of the first major broadcast networks in the world was Radio Vatican. And one of the Italians that helped invent radio. I should remember this. We took the Marconi. Thank you. Yeah, Marconi helped set up the first radio towers in the Vatican Gardens, which are still there today. So there's a great, great tradition with the history of radio and the Vatican. So this is fascinating. Karol Wojtyła, in the 70s, when communism was still at its height, he would go into the Radio Vatican studios, and since they're on shortwave, they can travel, you know, in deep into Europe, and he would make messages against the commies and send them back into Poland, and he wouldn't get in trouble because he was broadcasting on shortwave, and he was broadcasting from Radio Vaticana. So the authorities in Poland, the communists, couldn't really suppress him. And between like 1970, whenever he became Archbishop of Krakow, up until the time he was, you know, elected Pope, he made something like 23 or 27 broadcasts from the studio we were in. So it was a great honor to be in the studio. So during that time and that week, here's where I get you a little bit of the insider information. Archbishop Rino Fisichella granted an interview for the show that week. And so I got to sit down with him in the offices of the Pontifical Council for the Promotion of New Evangelization. And I got to ask him some pretty neat questions about how this Year of Mercy came together. So this office of the Vatican was responsible for, if you remember, the Year of Faith we had a number of years ago. And remember, there was the Year for Priests, not the Year of Priests, very different. A lot of people call it the Year of Priests. It was the Year for Priests. We had that Year of St. Paul. And so we've had these different themed years in the last decade or so. Archbishop Rino Fisichella was called in by Pope Francis, and he said, I want to have a special year for mercy. And Archbishop Fisichella said, oh, okay, so like a year of mercy. He goes, no. Pope Francis said, I want to have an extraordinary jubilee year of mercy. So this was announced around this time, late summer of 14. So Pope Francis said, this is what we're going to do. We're going to have an extraordinary jubilee year. Now, as you know, in church history, the jubilee years go back to actually the Old Testament with the Israelites. They would have these jubilee years every 7 years. Debts would be forgiven. Time would be taken off of work. And to celebrate the glory of God, basically, and the covenant with the Israelites. And then, though, as a church, we started having these about 700, 650 years ago. And we would have them every 50 years or so. And then there would be these extraordinary years. And we've only had maybe two dozen extraordinary jubilee years out of this cycle of years. One was for the millennium. You probably remember that well, 2000, the jubilee year 2000. So this is an extraordinary jubilee year. This is something out of the normal. And of course, there's the tradition of the holy doors for the jubilee year and making pilgrimage to Rome. That was always part of the jubilee years. And Pope Francis wanted this to be even beyond. So you may have heard about the holy doors in the diocese. And we'll talk about that with the indulgence a little later. But I want to just give you a few things from Pope Francis as before we head into Benedict and the rule and mercy from the bull. And this is some of the meat and potatoes, some of the heart of why Pope Francis declared this extraordinary jubilee year of mercy. It is proper to God to exercise mercy, and he manifests his omnipotence particularly in this way. This is from the bull. St. Thomas Aquinas got quoted in the bull. Pope Francis goes on to say, St. Thomas Aquinas' words show that God's mercy, rather than a sign of weakness, is the mark of his omnipotence. God's mercy, rather than a sign of weakness, is the mark of his omnipotence. For this reason, the liturgy, in one of its most ancient collects, has us pray, O God, who reveal your power above all in your mercy and in forgiveness throughout the history of humanity, God will always be the one who is present, close, provident, holy, and merciful. Pope Francis goes on to say, Jesus Christ is the face of the Father's mercy. These words might well sum up the mystery of the Christian faith. Mercy has become living and visible in Jesus of Nazareth, reaching its culmination in him. The Father is rich in mercy, Ephesians 2:4. After having revealed his name to Moses as a, quote, merciful God and gracious, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness, Exodus 34:6. and has never ceased to show in various ways throughout history his divine nature. In the fullness of time, Galatians 4:4, when everything has been arranged according to his plan of salvation, he sent his only Son into the world, born of the Virgin Mary, to reveal his love for us in a definitive way. Whoever sees Jesus sees the Father, John 14:9. Jesus of Nazareth, by his words, his actions, and his entire person, reveals the mercy of God. And now these last two quotes I'd like to give from the bull speak directly to us for our time. We need constantly to contemplate the mystery of mercy. It is a wellspring of joy, serenity, and peace. Our salvation depends on it. Mercy, the word reveals the very mystery of the Most Holy Trinity. Mercy, the ultimate and supreme act by which God comes to meet us. Mercy, the fundamental law that dwells in the hearts of every person who looks sincerely into the eyes of his brothers and sisters on the path of life. Mercy, the bridge that connects God and man, opening our hearts to the hope of being loved forever despite our sinfulness. At times we are called to gaze even more attentively on mercy so that we may become a more effective sign of the Father's action in our lives. For this reason, I proclaimed an extraordinary Jubilee Year of Mercy as a special time for the Church, a time when the witness of believers might grow stronger and more effective. And again, that was from April 15th of 2015 on Divine Mercy Sunday. That's taken directly from the bull, Misericordiae Vultus. So here we are, a Dominican hanging out with Benedictines for a Sunday, a Saturday morning. And again, grateful to the invitation. And just to wrap up the time in Rome, so that Tuesday, the Holy Father assembled about 750 of 1,000 priests from around the world, met with him in a place called the Sala Reina, which is right next to the Sistine Chapel, if any of you have ever had the gift to go to Rome. A great gift. If every Roman Catholic could make it to Rome once in their life, and I know it's not cheap, maybe health or age or distance, and of course money, but I know we don't have the tradition of the Hajj, but I feel like we should almost all be, you know, asked to go to Rome once in our lives. I mean, any of you have been there, you know your love of Peter and Paul goes through the roof. The mystery of how these two Jewish guys ended up in the empire, the pagan empire, and how Christianity crossed with the empire. Fascinating. So Rome is a great gift from God if you have the time and health to go, or you have been, thank God. So we met with the Holy Father, and what was fascinating was most of the priests were religious, of the 1,000 priests, of the 750 were there. Of course, everybody in their different habits, a lot of Capuchins, Padre Pio's body there and St. Leopoldo's body, they're the two priests who are the patrons, if you will, of the Jubilee Year of Mercy, especially for the priests and the missionaries. They were there for veneration. Padre Pio looks pretty good. His hands are a little weathered, but otherwise, you know, for being one of the only priest male stigmatists in the entire history of the Church, or at least since Francis, that was publicly known, a public stigmatist, he looked pretty good. And St. Leopoldo's tiny. He's probably about this big. And St. Leopoldo, the Franciscan, the Capuchin, was famous because he was a famous confessor because he gave light penances out. And everybody loved going to him because he gave very light penances, maybe one Hail Mary, two Hail Marys, I don't know. And he said, oh, I'll do all the work, don't worry, you know. And then his words, he had one line as a priest, it haunts me, because I started reading a little bit more about St. Leopoldo's life, and he said, the only noble death for a priest is one of exhaustion. and believe me, as a hospital chaplain, you come back some nights, you know, and in a monastery, your brothers themselves will exhaust you, so your fellow monks, you know. Anyway, so we did get to meet with the Holy Father. It was a great, it was really fascinating, beautiful to be. We were given a little, so we were brought through all these winding stairs and back through by the papal apartment, back to the Vatican Gardens, back, and then finally we go upstairs, downstairs, then we end up in this beautiful room, and they gave us all headsets for the different languages, English, German, French, Italian, Spanish. And the Holy Father spoke to us in Italian. And there were Benedictines, Dominicans, Franciscans, Trappists. I don't know what the Carthusian habit looks like. I don't know if the Carthusian would be allowed to leave the monastery. But it was really quite beautiful. And then at the end of the meeting, one priest decided to start singing the Roman Salve, and everybody, all the priests joined in as the Pope was leaving. It was a very pretty moment. So the next day, we had a meet at 3 o'clock at these bronze doors where the Swiss Guard are. And that's where we had to go in and vest all the priests. We had to bring it, and we got a special stole for the missionaries in Mercy. I should have brought it with me looking back now. And then, oh, also that night, Tuesday night, the Holy Father has allowed the missionaries of Mercy to lift the excommunication on four particular sins. So there's six sins that that we hold that have automatic excommunication. Now, to be automatically excommunicated, you have to know that the sin you committed was excommunicable. So the six are, first is ordaining a bishop unlawfully, illegally. So if a bishop ordained another bishop without permission of the Holy Father, automatic excommunication. Second would be, as sad as it is, but the sin of abortion is excommunicable. I would say in my short time as a priest and being a confessor, especially in the hospitals when people are near death and they really want to make peace for their life, 99.8% of people do not know that it is excommunicable. And when that sin has been confessed to me, we don't even bring it up. Thank God people are coming to our Lord's mercy and making healing, especially in our post-Roe v. Wade times. And this is something we'll see a lot in the years ahead. Praise God. People making peace with maybe their unfortunate mistakes and sins. But most people don't know. So rarely do you even tell the penitent, you know, oh, you listen, did you know you're excommunicated? I mean, they've carried this for so long and it's such a heavy thing. Most people don't know. I've had no one who's known. So second thing is, they wouldn't have been excommunicated. They didn't know, you know. Second thing would be, or a third sin that's automatically excommunicatable is desecration of the Eucharist. So if someone stole the Eucharist, maybe for satanic masses, or they spit it out. Remember back in the 80s with Cardinal O'Connor in New York, when ACT UP would go into the church and receive the Eucharist and spit it out. There were a lot of protests against Cardinal O'Connor in St. Patrick's. That's excommunicable. Force against the Holy Roman Pontiff. So if someone tried to beat up the Pope, which is rare, hit the Pope, maybe that happens more internally and we don't see it behind the, but that's automatically excommunicated. Remember there was that woman who lunged at Pope Benedict a few years ago? Yeah, maybe, I don't know, but if she didn't know it was excommunicable, so, you know, was she even excommunicated? Fifth, deal with priests. These two deal with priests. Fifth and sixth. If a priest breaks the seal of confession, he's automatically excommunicated. So priests know that, you know, for the most part. And then the sixth would be, this is a little complicated, it's kind of sad, but it's real. So you see the gravity of the sin. If a priest absolves an accomplice in a sin that he has committed with him or her against the sixth commandment, thou shalt not commit adultery. So if a priest heard the confession of someone he just went out and had a sin of the flesh with, so if he had a concubine or a mistress and he would absolve her of what they just did, that's excommunicable. I know, it's not pleasant to think about. I know, it's not at all. But that's automatic excommunication. It's twisted when you think about it, what priest would do such a thing. But think about it though, I mean, that is a valid absolution. If you're in a room and you go into cardiac arrest and you can get out the last few words of "get me a priest" just before you black out, and there's four priests in the room, three are validly with their diocese and everything, and there's a fifth priest who's been laicized, right? That has left the priesthood, maybe went off, get married, whatever, which is allowed. I mean, that does happen. You could ask for that priest, by canon law, who's laicized, married with kids, hasn't been an active priest in 30 years, to hear your confession, even with three other validly single, consecrated religious priests in the room. You're a priest forever, according to Melchizedek. So in danger of death, excuse me, that was a caveat that canon law has, in danger of death. But the reason I bring that up, to use that as a counterexample or a parallel, so it shows that even though a priest would commit such a sin with a person and then absolve them, they received a valid absolution. That's the power of the priesthood, it never changes. So even though the mistress or the concubine, whatever you want to say, just got absolved by the priest she committed this affair with for years and years, let's say, or he or whatever, that's a valid absolution. I mean, that's the power of the priesthood, ex opere operato, you know. I mean, that despite the sins of the priest, you can never change the power, the sacramental power, the character that is put on the priest's soul. Fascinating. Sad, but fascinating. Yes, question.
So she's forgiven.
She's forgiven and the priest is excommunicated. Yeah, exactly. That's what's happened. So, okay, all these excommunications we talked about. Normally what would have to happen by canon law, The person would come into the confessional. They can come in anonymously. They don't have to reveal themselves. We still have the non. Father, I was in a cult for many years. I've recently come back to the faith. We used to steal the Eucharist once a month, and we would go into the woods and we'd have a black mass. Father, I saw the light. My mother prayed her rosary for 20 years. I got out of the cult. Thank God I'm here. I would like to confess this. All right, so then that situation, I would say, okay, well, you realize this is excommunicable. And then, so what I would have had, what a priest would have had to do is they would have made an appointment with the penitent, and they would have said, okay, can you meet me in 1 month? Yes. Then the priest would write to Rome in a sealed envelope with a return envelope in, all anonymous. I'm Father blah, blah, blah of such and such diocese with faculties in good standing, la, la, la. I have a penitent who has come to me, who has been excommunicated for the sin of desecration of the Eucharist. Will you please lift the excommunication from them? So two things can happen. In the confessional, I can say to the penitent at the end of the confessional, not me as a missionary of mercy, this is an average Joe priest before this, the missionaries of mercy. Okay, well, is it implicit that you have absolution? Well, yes, Father. Okay, so you could absolve the person in the confessional, because any priest can forgive any sins. Got to remember that. I mean, this is the power of Christ, especially in danger of death. But what could happen is that you could absolve the sin, but the cage of excommunication, would you will, had not been lifted yet. So the penitent who desecrated the Eucharist with the cult could be absolved there and then, but the excommunication would still remain. Then what would happen is you would set up an appointment with the person in the confessional, and you would say, okay, so a month's time, July 11, 2016, I'll meet you back here at 5 p.m. Comes back in, hi, Father, I'm the penitent from last month. Yes, yes, yes. The letter would have come back from the Apostolic Penitentiary in Rome saying, we authorize Father such and such to lift the ban of excommunication on as of July 11th, going forward, blah, 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 for the blah, blah, blah. Then I would read, the priest would read the excommunication would be lifted, the person would be free on their way back in happy graces with the church. Also, there's one nuance with the absolution, and I'm sorry I didn't study this better. I think there is a caveat where you can ask the penitent, can they wait for the absolution, the excommunication to happen, the lift of the excommunication to happen at the same time? But of course, we never want to leave someone's soul out of a state of grace not being absolved. So that's why there is the time to let's forgive the sin now, but we'll take care of the excommunication from Rome. So basically, thank you for that big canon law lesson that I was allowed. I didn't mean to go into canon law that much. But what happens then now is that with all the missionaries of mercy throughout the world is that if a penitent comes in, any of those sins, except for the bishop and except for... the Holy Father has allowed all priests throughout the world for the Jubilee Year of Mercy be able to lift the excommunication of abortion. In most places in the United States, or most places where it was legal and prevalent, the priests were already given that power by their ordinary bishop. Many religious, as Dominicans, we've been allowed to lift that excommunication for ages. But now all priests can. There were places in the world where if a man or a woman was involved, and you get equally both people confessing that, men and women, if they were involved, they would have had to go to the bishop. The bishop would have had to lift the excommunication. Those were places like, I think, for example, maybe it was in regions in Mexico, for example, where it was illegal. It's illegal in Mexico City now. But where, so if the priest had met that, they would send them on to the bishop. So that was lifted. So the only thing that can't be lifted is the beating up of the, that can be lifted. The ordaining illegally of a bishop. So basically now, as missionaries of mercy, these people can come in with these four sins, and throughout the world, there are 1,000 priests who can lift them. So I've had people come to me this year. They found that we were here and out. Yes, and we're going to have Q&A at the end, but real quick. Yeah. Yeah.
Is that sin also one that has to be done with knowledge that is excommunicable, or is that automatically excommunicable regardless of whether or not you have knowledge?
Yeah, all right, so it's automatically excommunicable across the board, all those sins. But if you don't have the knowledge that you didn't know, you're so far from your faith and you don't know the nuances of canon law of any of these, The priests involved with these six sins are going to know. I mean, we know, you know. That's, it's our job to know. And we're taught to know. But for the lay folk who are involved with these, if they don't have knowledge, they're not excommunicated. You have to have the knowledge of that. So if I was in that cult and I did desecrate the Eucharist for all those years, you know, and I didn't, I think by God's grace, you're going to know. I mean, if you're in a cult and you know you're stealing the Eucharist, I mean, you know there's a gravity, there's a depth, there's a darkness, there's something deeply wrong about that. But that's why they want the Eucharist, you know, because they know it's the most powerful thing on earth, you know. And for the person to not, if they don't know, then they wouldn't have been. I know it sounds kind of weird. Like, wait, if you're automatically excommunicated, but then if you don't know, you're not excommunicated. Yeah. So it's
Actually, I'm kind of thinking of your sort of faithless college kid. Yeah. Who does this thinking it's, you know, more of a rogue
thing? Sure. 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 Sure.
What you've done.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, all right, so think about this. If they've realized let's say it was a fraternity prank, you know, we used to, you know, go down to the whatever, and that was the big thing. If you could do this, you got into Appa Kappa Phi Epsilon, whatever. And then obviously the depth of the sin knowing, I mean, that would have been a movement of grace in the heart of this college kid. So even though there wasn't a willful destruction, it still was a desecration. Even though it wasn't intended for something occultish or black mass, but it still was a desecration. So even spitting it out. Yeah, I mean, not someone who's sick or someone who's dementia in the nursing home and spits out the Eucharist accidentally or something when you're an extraordinary minister. I mean, obviously that's not. But even something that was more of a prank versus a direct attack on the Eucharist of the occult, yeah, that would have the same gravity to the sin, yeah. Good. Okay, so I know we're Benedictines and Dominicans meeting together, so we don't want to move away from the rule too much. And actually, this is funny. On my timer, I've got 26 seconds left. So for our first time, so we didn't even touch the rule, which is good though, because I actually got a really cool surprise. I found a really cool surprise about Aquinas and humility. So let me preview what we're going to talk about in the rule. Let's do that. So thank you for letting me share for the first portion the Jubilee Year of Mercy. And how were missionaries of mercy? A little bit of canon law, unexpectedly, but still fascinating to learn this stuff about the church. And then also, too, remind me when we're done to talk about the indulgence with the mercy doors. I want to definitely hit that before we're done. But before we break, here's what we're going to hit on for the rule and mercy in the next part. So we're going to be, the word mercy appears in the rule six times, in the rule of St. Benedict. Thank you for PDF searches. You type in mercy, boom, amazing, the PDF document scanners. It first appears in chapter 4 of the rule, in Instruments of Good Works. So chapter 4 of the rule, Instruments of Good Works, the word mercy first appears in the rule. Chapter 7 of Humility, it then appears in the rule. Chapter 7 in Humility, the degrees of humility, the 7 that Benedict talks about. Then it appears in chapter 53, the word mercy appears on reception of guests. Reception of guests, chapter 53, so we're going to talk about that. And then, finally, in chapter 64 of the rule, in the election of an abbot. So again, just to recap what we're going to talk with in the next section, Instruments of Good Works, chapter 4, Humility, chapter 7, Reception of Guests, chapter 53, and the election of an abbot. But what I want to do is, in the next part, we're going to talk first about humility, because that's key. Then we'll talk about the abbot and the guests, because those are brief and small. And then we'll finish with the corporal and spiritual works of mercy, the instruments of good works in the eyes of St. Benedict. If there's time, we'll just have a prayerful reading of Psalm 51, the Miserere, that we pray every Friday morning in the Psalter. Now, the Benedictines, you guys are on a slightly different Psalter cycle than we are. Don't you? You go through a little quicker than we. So do the lay people go? We go on a four-week Psalter cycle. Do the laity go a little quicker than the monks? You're on a different cycle. Oh, okay, okay. All right, I see then. Okay, so that's what we'll do. We'll take a break. We'll talk about, we got the four areas of the rule. We'll talk about the corporal and spiritual works of mercy, which are part of the indulgence, actually, I have from Pope Francis. And then we'll finish up with Psalm 51. So good. Thank you.
Thank you.